All right, well, good morning. It is good to be together, looking forward to our breaking bread here in just a little bit. But before we get there, I think we need to work up an appetite. And so I'm going to invite you to an exercise of turning to Matthew chapter 12. Matthew 12, page 689 in your pew Bibles. The words will be on the screen as well, so I guess that may be cheating, but either way is just fine. As you're doing that, let me go ahead and dismiss. If you are a young one, you are dismissed, released, free to go with hope to Children's Church. And they're getting their exercise, running out the door. Today I want to invite us, we'll get to Matthew 12 in 6 minutes. I want to, don't time me on that. Somebody's looking at their watch, right? I want to invite us to return, think last week. I want us to return to what is that idea of freedom. Noting that, and again, think last week, noting that whether we see freedom, whether we view freedom, whether we engage freedom as a way of, as for gain or for giving, at the core is choice, right? There's a choice. We could say freedom to choose. Now, to get at that, enter stage right, a man by the name of Stephen Wang, figuratively, not literally. Stephen Wang, he's a well-known fixture in the Church of England or in the Church in England. Most recently, he served at Allen Hall Seminary, the director of systematic theology, dean of studies. And he kind of dives into this idea a little bit. And to get at that, he writes three what are rather generic statements. So just stay with me on this for a few moments. He writes three kind of generic statements that help us to get at this understanding of freedom. Now, I didn't like one of his statements, so I changed it. So these are two of his, one of mine. I'm not going to tell you which one. But he writes this. He writes, he runs away because he is a coward. He writes, they care for their children because they are devoted parents. He writes, she works hard because she is a loyal employee. Which at first glance, I mean, we look at those, and those are fairly benign assertions. But I would suggest that if we go just below the surface, we notice that they reflect or reveal the way in which we relate one's identity to one's activity. Now, side note, just real quick, when I speak of identity here, I am not speaking in the more narrow sense that I think is kind of in the world today of gender identity. That's not what I mean here. What I'm speaking of is a broader identity, and we can think maybe of character, identity as character, or personality traits. And so I want us to think in that kind of broader sense, as one's character relates to one's actions. For example, again, we could put it like this, because he is a coward, think identity, he runs away, activity. Because they are devoted parents, identity, they care for their children, activity. Because she is a loyal employee, identity, she works hard, activity. So again, yes, still rather benign sorts of statements, not much to see here, so let's just move on, except perhaps there's a little bit of a different approach or a different viewpoint. Maybe there's a little bit of a different perspective. And so enter stage left, a 20th century French existential philosopher by the name of Jean-Paul Sartre. Jean-Paul Sartre, and he suggested that maybe it is not so much your identity that leads to your activity, but maybe it is your activity that informs or enlightens or shapes your identity. So rather than, stay with me here, so rather than he runs away because he is a coward, maybe we could say he is a coward because he runs away. Instead of they care for their children because they are devoted parents, maybe they are devoted parents because they care for their children. She works hard because she is a loyal employee, and we could try she is a loyal employee because she works hard. All of which I would suggest to you this morning is profoundly more than just simply wordplay, more than just what we would think of as maybe a semantics. As Stephen Wang notes, he writes, in his reflection on action, Sartre goes to the very heart of what it is to be human. What is, in a word, freedom? And maybe even more specifically, what is our freedom to choose? Identity, continues Wang, is not a straitjacket, nor does it predetermine the future. Right? His point being, we all have the freedom to choose. We all have the freedom to choose our actions, and consequently then, to choose what kind of person we will be and become. In his book, Being and Nothingness, Sartre reflects on this freedom we are all, in his words, condemned to live with. Along the way, inviting us to engage, and he writes, walking a narrow path. I was actually going to put up a picture here, but he says to imagine, so we're going to imagine. Walking along a narrow path without a guardrail, which goes along a precipice. To which Stephen Wang then writes, many people have had an experience of vertigo akin to this. On the one hand, looking into the abyss, on the other hand, aware of our total freedom. What amounts to a choosing, whether we are aware of it or not, it amounts to a choosing. From Wang, the more we reflect on it, the more we realize that we are not bound by it, and we become dizzy with the possibilities that open up before us. We could be reckless and jump for no reason at all, and this is what really terrifies us. The cliff walker, if you will, invites us to that kind of a reflection, to embrace the freedom to choose, realizing that we are not bound, but that the possibility is open before us, freedom to choose. And I believe we see this played out on the stage of Matthew 12, kind of in the interplay between the Pharisees and his disciples. And he begins here, Matthew 12, verse 1. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. Now, on the surface, this passage is about the Sabbath, absolutely. But if we also think back to last week, Shavim Panim LaTorah, right? The Torah has 70 faces, turn it around and around, for everything is in it. So on one level, yes, this is absolutely about the Sabbath. But underneath, we could say that this, the deeper significance is about freedom. Now, the quick sort of backstory here, interesting, because the section begins with 12 and 1. It reads, at that time. Not at that place, i.e. in the grain fields, but it says at that time. That can also be translated as season. And what makes that interesting is that if we go back to Genesis, to kind of the very first reading of what is this idea of Sabbath, it offers us simply a sort of pattern of rest, perhaps of work and rest. Chapter 2 and verse 3, notice it says, then God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the works of creating that he had done. And so from the very beginning, we have this pattern that is put forth, right? This pattern of work and rest. What is also interesting here is that within this first mention, there is no command. Right? It simply says he blessed the day, made it holy, and rested. Right? So there's no laundry list of rules and regulations here, right, that kind of govern what this looks like. Now, later on in Exodus 20 and verse 8, we pick up there, we read, remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work. And then it goes on, neither you, not your son, daughter, male, female servant, animals, foreigner, a foreigner residing in your home. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So here, yes, we do have a command. But again, notice what is commanded, right? Remember, keep it holy, don't work. In a word, we could say Sabbath was freedom. Sabbath was freedom. Again, no laundry list of rules here, right? Nothing, no laws to govern what that kind of looks like, right? Sabbath, in the sense, it was a gift. It was a gift of freedom. And so here is Matthew reminding us of that reality simply by writing at that time. He goes on, at that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. And so here we have Jesus, right? He's with his disciples. It says they're walking through some fields. And the disciples, being hungry, they begin to pick and eat these heads of grain. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to Jesus, "Look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath." Which is kind of interesting, because there is nothing in the Torah, by Torah I think Old Testament, but even more specifically the first five books of the Old Testament, what is known as the Pentateuch or the books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, the first five. There is nothing there that prohibits the picking and eating of grain on the Sabbath. However, in what is called the Mishnah, what is a compiling together of the ancient oral law into written form, there we have the prohibition against, it says, gathering and reaping. Noting that the oral law, the Mishnah, are laws that were intended to kind of elucidate our understanding of the written law or the written Torah. And so the disciples here are not breaking Torah. In fact, Jesus, clearly, he makes it clear that he's all for the Torah. Now, he kind of reinterprets a lot of the Torah. But Matthew 5:18, he says, "For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen, will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished." I would say from the law as it's rightly understood. Now, with that, the oral law is not all bad. Its intent is to bring a deeper understanding of the written law or the written Torah. And so this is not kind of like Torah good, written Torah good, and oral law, Mishnah bad. That's not what this is. In fact, it's best not even to think of the oral law maybe as a monolith. According to Jewish scholarship, the massive amounts of oral law that have been condensed into the Mishnah and into the Gemara can be divided into eight categories, ranked according, it says, to their relative level of authority. And so it's not all bad here. But we also want to keep in mind that with that, it does contain, in addition to these what we think of as laws and rules and regulations, it also contains what we think of as traditions. And Jesus has something to say about the traditions of men. Going on, verse 3, Jesus answered, "Haven't you read what David did?" Which is like, again, I love this, because it's like saying to a doctor, "Haven't you heard about the common cold?" Right? I mean, of course. I mean, these are Pharisees. Their world revolves around the scriptures. Of course they've read and heard about what David did. So it's a little bit, sarcastic maybe. He answered, "Haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and he and his companions ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do." And then if we drop down to verse 7, "If you had known what these words mean, 'I desire mercy, not sacrifice,' which is a quote then from Hosea, 'you would not have condemned the innocent.'" Now, there is all sorts of backdrop to this, especially as it relates to the Sabbath. I don't want to go there today. But Jesus is, in effect, saying to the Pharisees, "Hold up, guys, you have it all kind of backwards and upside down. The Sabbath, it was made for you and me." Right? Man was not made for the Sabbath. Sabbath was made for you and me. We are not slaves to the Sabbath. It is not some harsh, oppressive rule, right? It's a gift. In a word, it's freedom. In a word, it's freedom to choose, which is why in their hunger, it says they are picking and eating the grain. In their hunger, they are choosing the nourishment. They're choosing to pick and eat the grain, right? The freedom to choose. Jesus' disciples, it's like they're walking along the narrow path, no guardrail, looking into the precipice, not bound. The possibilities are open before them. And what do? They choose mercy. They choose mercy. Matthew then goes on, taking us right into to another story, verse 5. Going on from that place, Jesus went into their synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand, that can be translated as deformed, man with a shriveled hand, deformed hand, was there. Looking for a reason to bring charges against Jesus, they asked him, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" Which is really, in my opinion, humble opinion, the epitome of kind of religious spirit, right? That attitude of kind of that heart bent towards cynicism and criticism, which I'm thankful, you know, nothing like any of us would do at all. So we'll just move on from that. Verse 11, it says, "He said to them, if any of you has a sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will you not take hold of it and lift it out?" Right? Again, in a sense, he's asking the question, which would you choose, mercy or sacrifice? Which one would you choose? Verse 12, "How much more valuable is a person than a sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." Now, it's interesting here, just by way of contrast or comparison, in both Mark and Luke's Gospels, it phrases that in terms of a question, where Jesus is asking them, which is lawful on the Sabbath? It says to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it. Then Jesus said to the man, verse 13, "Stretch out your hand." So he stretched it out, and it was completely restored, just as sound as the other. Again, Jesus makes a choice. The choice is for mercy, which you would think would be a reason to celebrate. You think of this would be a reason to throw a party. But what happens? Not at all. There's no party. In fact, probably a party because not only was the deformed man's hand healed, but because he had a deformed hand, he would have been cut off from the temple, which means, in effect, he had been cut off from God. And so, in a sense, Jesus, I mean, this was mercy, but Jesus was giving him life, right? Restoring his life. But there's nothing here about a celebration. Instead, we read, "But the Pharisees went out and plotted how they might kill Jesus," which, again, I think is the epitome of irony. Now, in all fairness, it has been true for me that I tend to think of the Pharisees as bad guys. And it's understandable from our viewpoint, right? I mean, they're trying to kill our hero, right? So it makes sense to kind of see the Pharisees as bad guys. But again, in the first century, the Pharisees were very well respected. They were kind of would have been considered to be kind of the Bible-believing men and women. They were serious about the Torah, serious about the commandments of God, serious about what it meant to be holy, serious about being a people of holiness, probably more than any other group. The problem is that in their quest, right, rule upon rule upon rule upon rule was made, and over time, adhering to those rules became more important. And so the Torah, specifically remember the Sabbath, keep it holy, don't work, in effect rest, became hijacked by don't climb a tree because it may lead to breaking twigs, and that would be considered reaping. Became do not spit on the ground and wipe it with your feet, as crevices might be leveled, and that is considered plowing. Became do not squeeze a pickle to extract liquid that would be threshing, and don't pick heads of grain for food, no matter how hungry you are. And what God intended to be a life-giving freedom, meant for good, for yours and mine, turned into a laundry list of these oppressive rules. But the Torah was never intended to be oppressive. In fact, Rabbi David Rosenfeld, and it is David, it's not David, He writes in Torah in the Tree of Life. He writes, "Great is Torah, for it gives life to its doers in this world and in the next world. For they, the teachings of the Torah, give life to those who find them and healing to all flesh. It is a tree of life to those who take hold of it, and those who support it are fortunate. For in me, the Torah, will you lengthen days, and years of life will be added to you. And peace will they, the Torah's teachings, increase for you." And so, yes, again, this is absolutely a story about Sabbath. But even more, I would suggest to you this morning, it's about freedom. And not just freedom, but the freedom to choose. And the great news is it begins now. It begins, we could say, right here today. Right? Your identity does not define you. The good news is that your identity, your past, does not define you. You can choose today. Stephen Wang, we are not bound by it. Right? Now, you might become dizzy with all the possibilities that open up, but this is the invitation, right? The freedom to choose, to be, to maybe today not run away, but to stand and to be courageous, right? To be a devoted parent, to be a loyal employee, right? To walk the path, to look into that precipice and to ask, do I choose that which brings life or death? Do I choose that which brings life or brings death? With my family? With my friends? With my neighbors? With the other? That one maybe that I don't agree with, that I don't see eye to eye with? Maybe that one that I don't get along with, right? My enemies? On the Sabbath, absolutely. But how about Monday? How about Monday in the midst of an argument? Which do I choose then? How about on a Thursday when I'm driving along the road and somebody cuts me off? What do I choose? Is it life or is it death? We could ask, do I choose to do mercy or sacrifice? And keep in mind here, sacrifice is not in the sense of doing good for someone else and making a sacrifice, like I give up some of my money or clothing or giving someone a ride, something that would be inconvenient. That's not the sacrifice here. Thusia is the word in Greek, and it means to kill or to slaughter. And so in a sense, we could say, you know, which do I choose? Do I choose to do mercy or choose to do slaughter? Not to get too graphic, but do I choose to do mercy or sacrifice? For the hungry, for the hurting, for the lonely, for the tired, for the sick. Do we choose to do mercy or sacrifice? And then we could ask, which do we choose? Do I choose to do good or to bring harm? Today? Any day? Every day? Right? Anybody? Anyone? Everyone? Do I choose to do good or to bring harm? Walking a narrow path without a guardrail, which goes along a precipice. This is our freedom to choose, to do and to be and to become. We are not bound. And the possibilities are before us.